Good evening. Welcome to The Blues. I'm Lee Hay. On tonight's show, we'll focus on the book Up Jump the Devil, The Real Life of Robert Johnson, co-written by Bruce Conforth and Gail Dean Wardlow. Mr. Conforth spoke on June 12th with Ron Esposito. We'll hear that interview along with six songs by Robert Johnson. And at the end of the show, after the interview, we'll hear three songs by Eric Gale, Susan Tedeschi and Derek Trucks, and Joe Louis Walker from the album Hellbound On My Trail, Songs of Robert Johnson on the Blues.
I'm Ron Esposito, and this evening we'll be in conversation with author Bruce Conforth, talking about the latest book that he wrote with Gail Dean Wardlow about Robert Johnson, and it's called Up Jumped the Devil, The Real Life of Robert Johnson. It's a pleasure to have you with us on the Blues tonight, Bruce Conforth. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Ron. It's certainly a pleasure to be here. I appreciate you having me on.
You know, you're a guy that's very qualified to talk about Robert Johnson, given your past as a former professor of folklore, blues, popular culture, and American history at the University of Michigan, and also a founding curator of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Let's dive in to the life and the myth of Robert Johnson. In your book, you know, you talk about Johnson's relationship with family, friends in Memphis, his trip to New York, about his marriage and his relations with other women, and tells exactly how and why he died and who gave him the poison that killed him. So this has involved a lot of research and scholarship.
Well, yes, it did. We like to say that together, Gail Dean and I put over 100 years of effort into this work, because Gail Dean began his research into Johnston in the early 60s, and I began mine in the very late 60s. So we each have 50-plus years. So together, we've got like a century of research and experience trying to track down who this man was.
Yeah, and that is a real question in regard to Robert Johnson, isn't it? We have to take into consideration the cultural milieu in which Johnson came up in, particularly the Delta culture, in that there's been so much myth-making around Robert Johnson, right?
Well, there has. And you just hit one on the head right there in what you just said about the Delta blues music. Because Robert, essentially, was an urban kid. Robert grew up in Memphis. He spent from 2 until roughly the age of 9 in Memphis. And as they say, child is father of a man. And really, those 7 or 8 years that Robert spent in Memphis were the most important of his life, and they really shaped him. And they're what differentiated him from any of the other Delta blues musicians. Because all the others, Charlie Patton, Son House, Willie Brown, you name it, they all grew up on plantations or worked on plantations, whatever. Robert grew up in an urban environment. Robert heard jazz. Robert saw jazz. Robert saw W.C. Handy. He saw the Ringling Brothers Circus. He saw Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. He saw all kinds of things that kids on the plantation would have never had the experience to see. He went to school. He had to go to school. There was a great educational reformer named Julia Hooks in Memphis who made sure that all African-American children went to school. And so Robert, from the time he could read, before he could read, got training in arithmetic, geography, math, science, and music. Now, sure, his music lessons were probably pretty rudimentary, but still, he got a really great education. And so he was very, very different. To call Robert a Delta blues musician is really kind of a misnomer.
Boy, you make a really good point, Bruce. I never really thought of it in the way that you put it, because in my notes, I did write down, hey, you know, what about Son House? What about Charlie Patton? And you took care of it right there. All these people came up on the plantations, country people, where Robert came up in the city, which would have been a whole other experience. So what else can you tell us then about Robert's development in Memphis and then as he moves more out into the world?
Well, Robert had an incredibly traumatic young life. His mother abandoned him with her husband, not Robert's father, Charlie Dodds, who had changed his name to Charlie Spencer. So she abandoned Robert at the age of 2 in Memphis. And that's pretty much any child's worst nightmare, to be abandoned by your mother. And yet she did that, and she left him with this family of people that he didn't know. Another very traumatic experience. And then over the years, while he was in Memphis, he gradually began to accept that Memphis family as his own. And he really thought that this was his family. And then when he was about 9 or 10 years old, his mother, who at that point he didn't even recognize anymore, showed up, scared the bejesus out of him, and took him back away from the only family that he knew, and took him out of the city, out of the environment in which he was really comfortable, away from schooling, away from all the entertainment, and brought him down to Lucas Township in Arkansas to live with her new husband, a really slow-witted gentleman by the name of Dusty Willis, who kind of, if you're familiar with the old cartoon Peanuts, he kind of was like the character Pigpen, you know, because he got the nickname Dusty because everywhere he walked around, he used to kick up a cloud of dust around him. And Dusty, he wanted Robert to work on the plantation. And Robert, of course, being a city kid, didn't want to have anything to do with that.
So how did Robert get introduced to the guitar and get out and about in the area in which he lived and places to play?
Well, when he was still in Memphis, he had an older stepbrother, Charles Leroy, Charlie Leroy played both piano and guitar, and he was the one who introduced Robert to both of those instruments.
Oh.
And once Robert was turned on to those instruments, that was it. That's what he wanted to do the rest of his life. And it didn't hurt that Robert had a musically eidetic memory, which meant that if he heard something, he could play it. He didn't have to practice. If he, you know, it's almost like we talk about savants
yeah.
who can just play something. Well, Robert had an eidetic memory, and as long as he heard something, he didn't have to practice. He just knew how to play it. So Charlie introduces him to the guitar and piano. When he goes down to live with his mother, shortly after, his stepsister Carrie comes down, and his stepsister Carrie really supported him, helped him make his first cigar box guitar, and then helped him save a few pennies in order to buy his first actual guitar. It only had four strings, and he had to wait until he could save up another dime to buy the other two strings. But Robert started playing from a really very early age, and one thing that we found that was really fascinating that goes against all the stories and all the myths is that Robert was playing professionally by 1928.
And Robert made his first recordings, what, in San Antonio, what, in the late 30s, right?
In 1936.
So in those intervening years, what was it like for Robert as a musician and a man?
Well, a lot of things happened. In 1929, Robert got married to his sweetheart, Virginia Travis. She was 14, he was 18, but they lied about their ages and they got married. And Robert said that he would give up playing the guitar and try and become a faithful farming husband. And not too long after, Virginia became pregnant, and she decided to go to her grandmother's house, which was about 100 miles away from where she and Robert were living at the time. And she was going to go there to have the baby. And Robert, sensing that, well, I'm going to be free for a little while now, my woman is gone, Robert picked up his guitar and started to play all the old joints that he used to know and work his way up the Mississippi River, up on Highway 1. When he finally got where Virginia had been staying at her grandmother's house, Virginia and the baby had already died in childbirth. She died of acute eclampsia. They had already been buried by the time Robert got there. And her whole family and the local community blamed Robert for the whole thing. They said, look, you know, the reason why Virginia and your baby are dead was because you were out there playing the devil's music. Imagine what kind of a guilt trip that is to have laid on you.
I know. Emotionally, this is scarring and traumatic for anyone. And at the same time, this devil's music is a brand that just seems to be replete through the blues mythology.
The blues was music of the flesh, and gospel music was music of the saints. You know, blues celebrated everything that the body had fun with, and gospel music celebrated everything in the hereafter. So, you know, it's not too difficult to understand how one could be classified as the devil's music, not the least of which was the whole idea that if guys were out juking on a Saturday night, spending all their money, they wouldn't be apt to be going to church on Sunday mornings. And so a lot of the preachers back in those days used to use that whole devil's music thing as a way of saying, you shouldn't be listening to this. You should be coming to church and giving us your money instead of giving it to some liquor peddler.
So, Bruce, how much did musicians or Robert buy into this whole notion of devil's music and all of that kind of stuff?
Well, you know, it was a very common folk belief in African-American folklore. It was a very common belief. There's folk songs and folk tales going back to the beginning of the century that talk about making a deal with either the devil or a big black man or selling your soul or whatever. The folklorist Zora Neale Hurston collected these stories mm-hmm. in the 30s. Another folklorist, Henry Hyatt, collected them. There were people who sang songs about selling souls to the devil as early as the 1920s. So the folklore in African American culture was very, very prevalent. And so whether or not Robert actually bought into it, there's no question that he knew about it.
Yeah.
And in some ways, you know, it's a pretty good marketing device. Because if you say, you know, I got the devil on my side, well, that kind of like gives you a certain kind of power, which is why someone like Petey Wheatstraw built himself as the devil's son-in-law.
I remember that. And wow, Bruce, you are so dead on it there as a marketing tool. So what you've just described for us sets up or explains to some degree the mythology of Robert Johnson going down to the crossroads and making a deal with the devil to become the musician that he was.
Well, yes, but of course, we found no evidence that Robert ever said that to anybody.
Right, and that's the myth-busting aspect of the book, Up Jumped the Devil, The Real Life of Robert Johnson. We're in conversation with Bruce Conforth, who, along with Gail Dean Wardlow, recently wrote this book. Ron Esposito with you on the blues. So, Bruce, I'm really just fascinated by everything you're telling us about Robert's life unfolding, particularly after the death of his wife and child. So how did Robert end up going to New York?
Well, that's a couple years later. I mean, after Virginia and the baby died, Robert moved back in with his mother for a short period of time. See, one of the things that he kept on doing throughout his entire life is going from the Delta to Memphis, because he really considered his Memphis family and Memphis as his real home. As a matter of fact, if you wanted to contact Robert, you had to do it through his Memphis family. So ultimately, there's a famous story that Son House told, and I heard Son House tell it many times. Son House used to tell the story that when Robert was just a little boy, when he used to come nosing around and he'd sit in there and he'd watch me and Willie Brown play. And then when we'd take a break, he'd sneak up and take one of our guitars and try to play it. But all he could do is make noise, and it used to just bother people. So they'd get us and we'd have to come in and take the guitar away from him. That's completely wrong. That is a completely erroneous and mythic story, because Son House didn't move to Robinsonville until 1930, after he got out of Parchment Farm. And as I said before, Robert had already been playing professionally since 1928. So Robert had already been playing professionally for two years before he met Son House. And he certainly wasn't a little boy when Son House met him, because as we also know, by 1930, he was a 19-year-old widower. So the Son House story goes completely out the window. What happened was that Robert got tired of getting into fights with his stepfather, and so he decided to go down to Hazelhurst, Mississippi, to look for his biological father, Noah Johnson. Because I think Robert spent his whole life really trying to find himself, trying to look for his own identity. And the first important part of that was to find his biological father. Well, he went down to Hazelhurst and couldn't find Noah anywhere. And it's really interesting, because all the research we did, we have absolutely no idea what happened to Noah. Noah just seems to have disappeared into thin air. But instead of finding Noah, Robert found a gentleman by the name of Isaiah Ike Zimmerman, who was a road worker, a highway worker, who had come in from Grady, Alabama, to build Highway 51. Ike was one of the best guitarists in all of southern Mississippi. And Ike took a liking to Robert and invited him to come and stay with him. And so Ike spent about 8 months with Robert living in his house, so much so that Ike's daughter used to say that he was here so much, Robert, that is, he was here so much that I actually thought he was kin. But Ike taught Robert the finer points. Obviously, Robert could already play, but Ike taught him the finer points on how to be a real blues musician. And Ike took him around to lumber camps and picnics and parties and fish fries until they were ready for Robert to go back up to the Delta, which they did, and blow Son House away. But two interesting things happen. While he's living with Zimmerman, he impregnates a woman named Virgie Mae Smith, who ultimately gives birth to his son Claude, who just a little while ago passed away. But Robert desperately wanted to marry Virgie. He really did. And he made four attempts to go to her family to try to get her to marry him. But once again, here it comes, that same old thing. They said, no, we're not going to let her marry you because you play the devil's music. So once again, Robert was denied a wife and a child because he played the devil's music. So as a kind of like rebound to that, he married a woman named Callie Kraft, who was a few years older than him and had a couple of kids who really used to dote on him. And that's when all three of them, Callie, Robert, and Ike Zimmerman, went back up to the Delta. And that's when we have the famous scene where Robert walks into a juke joint where Willie Brown and Son House are playing. And Robert says, let me show you what I can do. And Son says, I don't believe that you can do anything. And Robert says, well, just let me try. And in such archetypal fashion, I mean, this is almost straight out of the most well-known myths. Robert literally takes the seat of the master. Robert, as the novice, goes and sits in Son House's chair and blows him away.
I'm getting goosebumps, man, just imagining that. And of course, you know, in my notes in preparation for this interview, you know, one of the first things I wrote down was myth making and archetypes. And I mean, you just described it right there. You know, the older generation gives way to the newer generation. The student eclipses the teacher at some point. This is all archetypal.
It is. But when you talk about myth making, too, you know, that's another reason why we wrote the book, because so much speculation was put forward about Robert and so many interpretations. You know, since so little was known about his life, basically what the early scholars did is they tried to interpret what Robert's life was probably like through reading his lyrics. And what that tells us, it doesn't tell us anything about Robert, but it tells us what the people interpreting the lyrics thought about Robert.
Ooh, well stated.
And so what happens in that case is that Robert ceases to become Robert Johnson, the man, and he begins to become Robert Johnson, the myth.
Yeah.
And so Gail Dean and I really wanted to say, you know what, we need to stop this proliferation of Robert Johnson, the myth, and we need to give him back his identity as a man.
So hence your deep scholarship and investigation and tracking people down, looking at death certificates, the whole nine yards, right?
Exactly. We refused to put anything in the book that we couldn't corroborate in several different ways. It wasn't enough just to get like a testimony from one person. We'd have to get a testimony from a few other people that verified that.
Yeah.
And even at that point, we would then say, okay, well, let's see if we can find any documentation. Are there death certificates? Are there birth certificates? Are there census records? Are there city directories? Are there newspaper accounts? Is there any other primary data that will help us validate this? And it was only when we put all of that stuff together that we were happy to include something in the book. So pretty much we feel that everything in the book is absolutely 100% correct.
Well, brother, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, as a lifelong guy who's listened to and played the blues and a student of African-American culture and a real deep appreciator for the Delta influence, this book, it's eye-opening in many ways. Anyway, why don't you tell us about the recordings and then Robert's demise in the time that we have left.
Robert had an incredible talent to codify what he heard before. Almost all of the 29 songs that he recorded were takeoffs on earlier recordings. Come On in My Kitchen was stolen from Mississippi Sheik's Sitting on Top of the World. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining her do. A woman I love took for my best friend. Some joker got lucky, stole her back again. He better come on in my kitchen. It's hard to be running out of. While she's gone, I know she won't come back. I take the last liquor out of her nation, sir. He better come on in my kitchen. It's going to be raining out of.
Hey, can't you hear that wind, huh? Oh, can't you hear that wind, huh?
You better come on in my kitchen. It's going to be raining out of. Gets in trouble, everybody throws her down. Looking for a good friend, how can be found. You better come on in my kitchen. It's going to be raining out door. And the time's coming, it's gonna be slow. You can't make the winter break. Let's dry long so. You better come on in my kitchen. Cause it's going to be raining outdoors.
Kind-hearted woman was taken from Leroy Carr's Cruel-hearted woman.
just to have it on your mind.
Traveling Riverside Blues was taken basically from Hambone Willie Newburn's Rolling and Tumbling.
If your man get brazen down, won't you have your fun? If your man get brazen down, won't you have your fun? Come on back to Fried Point, Mama, bail us all night long. I got women in Vicksburg, clean on in the Tennessee. I got women in Vicksburg, clean on in the Tennessee. But my Fried Point rider, now she hops all over me. I ain't gonna stay no color, but her front teeth is crowned with gold. I ain't gonna stay no color, but her front teeth crowned with gold. She gotta lean on my body now, mark is on my soul. I'm going to Rodale, take my rider by my side. But I'm going to Rodale and take my rider by my side. I be gonna bail us all night long, horses on the driver's side. Now you may squeeze my lemon till the tears run down my day. You may squeeze my lemon till the tears run down my day. Babe, I'm going back to Fried Point if I be rocking to my head.
From Four Until Late was taken from the Memphis jazz musician Johnny Dunn's 1922 recording, 4 o'clock Blues.
Too late, I was wringing my hands and crying. I'm found too late, I was wringing my hands and crying. I believe to my soul that your dad is Memphis to Norfolk is a 36-hour ride. From Memphis to Norfolk is a 36-hour ride. Amen, it lack a prisoner and he's never satisfied. A woman is lack a dresser. Some man always ramming through his drawers. A woman is like a dresser. Some man's always ramming through his drawers. It costs so many men when they burn overhaul. From Fontelli, she gives a no good bunch and clown. From Frontale, she give up a no good bunch and clown. Now she won't do nothing but tear a good man reputation down. When I leave this town, I'm gonna bid you farewell. leave this town, I'm gonna bid you farewell. And when I return again, you'll have a great long story to tell.
Sweet Home Chicago was taken from Kokomo Arnold's 1934 recording of old original Kokomo blues. There's virtually no song that Robert did, with a few exceptions, that he didn't use some other recording as his basis for. But what Robert did, Robert codified and simplified and took these songs and made them his own in a really important way. And like a great example is Sweet Home Chicago, an old original Kokomo blues. If you listen to Kokomo Arnold's version of it, it's great. It's virtuosic. His slide guitar playing is fantastic. However, it sounds like he's had way too many cups of coffee. He's just literally all over the place. And the slide guitar playing doesn't seem to have a whole lot to do with the actual song itself. What Robert does is say, all right, you know, I'm going to take the basic outline of this song. I'm going to take, instead of doing this like really manic guitar part, I'm going to create this single guitar riff that will become identifiable. And I'm going to make the guitar 100% integrated with the vocal so it becomes a holistic piece. Because he was a child of records and the radio, Robert had a very different idea of how a song should sound than his predecessors. You know, when Son House played a song, when Charlie Patton played a song, when Willie Brown played a song, they play it different every time they played it. might have 5 verses, 8 verses, 11 verses, 3 verses, 2 verses, fast, slow. You never know. Robert had this idea that, you know, every time I hear a song on the radio, it sounds exactly the same. Every time I hear a song on a record, it sounds exactly the same. So my songs should be exactly like that. And so he was really the first of the, and I'm going to use it, even though I'm not crazy about it, but the first of the country blues musicians, the first of the acoustic blues musicians from that era, to think of songs in an holistic way as a complete and fixed piece of art. And that was a major, major change. And because of that, he basically codifies everything that came before him and sets the stage for everything that comes after him.
Man.
Because if you listen to the earliest recordings of Muddy Waters, what are they? They're Robert Johnson. Even when he starts playing electric, I Can't Be Satisfied or I Feel Like Going Home, it's his first records for Chess. They're just him and a bass, and he's playing Robert Johnson licks on an electric guitar. So Robert Johnson is basically responsible for transforming the blues into what becomes Muddy Waters. And then Muddy Waters, of course, helps feed into rhythm and blues, and rhythm and blues becomes rock and roll. And here we are.
Boy, that was a wonderful articulation that you just did for us, particularly in the way that Robert approached the songs and the playing and really set a standard for the integration of all of this. Okay, so to get to the closing of our talk here, why don't you tell us about Robert's demise?
Well, I think we should leave that to the reader. I mean, there's probably a lot of the people who are familiar with Robert Johnson will find something familiar in the story, but then they'll also find a lot of things that they didn't know, because it was really a very tragic ending, tragic in a lot of ways.
Well, let's leave it at that then, Bruce. I have so enjoyed this conversation with you, and it is obviously apparent how much you have studied, how much time you have put into this. And I tell you what, I don't know if you're still teaching, but you sound like you were a fantastic professor.
Well, thanks a lot. No, I'm not teaching at the moment. So little plug out there, give me a call.
All right.
Can I just say two more things very quickly that I'm really very proud of? In less than 3 days after its official release, the entire first printing was sold out. And the UK edition has been nominated for the Penderin Prize, which is a prize in England given to that year's best music biography or history.
Well, congratulations, Bruce. And once again, we've been in conversation with Bruce Conforth, along with Gail Dean Wardlow. They authored the book, Up Jump the Devil, The Real Life of Robert Johnson. For the blues, I'm Ron Esposito.
And now three songs from the album Hellbound on My Trail, Songs of Robert Johnson. The first by Eric Gales, followed by Susan Tedeschi and Derek Trucks, and Joe Louis Walker closes out the show on the blues.
Early this morning, when you knocked upon my door. Early this morning, when you knocked upon my door. And I said, hello, Satan. I believe it's time to go. Me and the devil was walking side by side. Ooh, yeah. Me and the devil walking side by side. And I'm going to beat my woman until I get satisfied. So you say you don't see why that your dog me around. Now, baby, you know you ain't treating me right, don't you? She say you don't see why that your dog me around. Woo! It must be that old evil spirit so deep down in the ground.
Help! mistreated that I surely don't mind. I am, yes, I feel so mistreated. Lord, I don't mind. I am. Well, I've been mistreated, baby, and I don't mind. I am. So people tell me that the world of blues ain't bad. It's the world's most feeling. I think this old girl ever had. Well, some people tell me these old world of blues ain't so bad. Oh, it's the world's most feeling. Now he got every movement from his head down to his toes, breaking it out of doubt the most everywhere that he goes. Now he got every movement from his head down to his toes. Lord, that man breaks in on a dollar most anywhere that he goes.
yes, I believe my time ain't long. I got to leave this place, leave my happy home.
That was Dust My Broom, Joe Louis Walker, Walking Blues by Susan Tedeschi and Derek Trucks, and beginning the set, Eric Gales with Me and the Devil Blues from the album Hellbound on My Trail, Songs of Robert Johnson. Thanks for listening to The Blues on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford. I'd like to thank Ron Esposito for his in-depth conversation with Bruce Conford about the book Up Jump the Devil, The Real Life of Robert Johnson. Thanks for listening. I'm Lee Hay.